From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With economic reports showing signs of improvement, many Americans are wondering why it still feels so tough out there, and when and how it really gets better. Today, we're going to ask two big thinkers to look far beyond the latest jobs report and quarterly results to where America's economy is headed and what it will take for the country, the whole country, to prosper. One says Reaganomics is out of gas and we need a new way. The other, machines are going to take the jobs and we've got to deal with that. This hour on Point, a deep think on the economy and how to make it work for all Americans. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you seeing? An economy that works for you, for many, for most, or not? What do you think needs to change? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A little sound of celebration over the jobs numbers last week. Here was the president, happy to take some credit here to tout these in Knoxville, Tennessee, touting Friday's new jobs numbers.
In December, our business has created 240,000 new jobs. Our unemployment rate fell to 5.6%, which is the lowest in 6.5 years. What that means is 2014 was the strongest year for job growth since the 1990s.
Okay, hooray, but let's get into those jobs. Here's Latasha Irby. She works in a Hyundai parts plant in Selma, Alabama. She makes $11.33 an hour. In the automotive industry, she's been at the company for 9 years. She talked to NPR last week. She says she's making Walmart wages in the auto industry.
You would think that you're working for an auto manufacturer, you would get paid more. I mean, we're getting paid like Walmart wages.
Walmart wages building cars. This is not the way it was. Let's look at how it might be going forward. Joining me now from New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts, is David Kotz. He's professor of economics, University of Massachusetts, and at the Shanghai University of Finance and Economics in China. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. Excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Kotz, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
And with me in the studio is Eric Brynjolfsson, professor of management science at MIT Sloan School of Business, professor of information technology, director of the Center for Digital Business, co-author with Andrew McAfee of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Eric Brynjolfsson, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Tom.
David, let me come to you first. You say that capitalism runs in cycles. It has different flavors in different cycles, and that we are running to the end of a cycle now. Describe that for us, David.
Well, that's what history shows. Capitalism has taken a series of distinct forms based on different institutions, each lasting one to several decades. And we're now at the end of one of those periods, the free market, sometimes it's called neoliberal form of capitalism, that emerged around 1980, although it really predated by a few years President Reagan, did promote long economic expansions for some 25 years. But the 2008 financial crisis and Great Recession marked the end of the ability of that form of capitalism to continue to promote economic expansion. We're now in what should be called a structural crisis.
Structural crisis meaning the sort of way we've done things, the shape of the economy that we're accustomed to, that we've built, not working.
Exactly. The economy is going nowhere. The job numbers look good, 5.6%. And in the past, the unemployment rate was a pretty good indicator of the condition of the labor market, but not so today.
Why not?
Because for the first time since they started keeping records, in the last several years, the labor force, the people who are either working or actively looking for work, has been shrinking relative to the population. It's called the labor force participation rate. Now we're 5.5 years into an economic expansion. If the percentage of the population of working age that is in the labor force was the same as it was 5.5 years into the previous expansion of the 2000s, the unemployment rate would now be 10.3% rather than 5.6%. The unemployment rate's fallen because people have left the labor force.
And you look around and you say it's a lot more than that, just sort of looking around at the way American society is running. You say wages have declined instead of rising. That's not supposed to be the American way. Families, tough time making ends meet with two wage earners. You write in the end of neoliberal capitalism. You say good industrial jobs have fled, job security plummets. While the pressures at work grow, social safety net cut back, public education squeezed all over the place, art and music classes shrinking, disappearing, PE out of there. The gap between the rich and the rest of society has exploded. You're laying all this at the feet of this last cycle of capitalism?
Well, the timing certainly fits. All these processes that you just described got underway after 1979. That's the year of the big shift in data series when the buying power of the average wage, instead of rising every year, began to fall, when inequality, instead of declining gradually as it had for several decades after World War II, began to rise sharply. All these trends changed, and it is explainable by the way the institutions and dominant ideas of the free market or neoliberal form of capitalism have worked. Labor unions have been weakened. The government has stepped back from regulating business. The government has stopped using its policies to promote a low unemployment rate. The global economy became much more open to movements of goods and especially capital. All of these things weakened labor's bargaining power and resulted in wages declining instead of rising. And it created great opportunities for those who move fast to get rich quickly.
You say that we're at the end of a cycle, but you sound like no fan of Reaganomics. A lot of Reaganomics folks would say, free market supporters would say, come on, have faith, just to free things up, and this tiger will roar again.
Well, exactly.
Why not?
Belief in austerity does represent just what you suggest. It's a belief that the only problem is the free market reforms didn't go far enough. But everywhere that austerity has been practiced, it's brought only faster economic decline. The way in which a free market, so-called form of capitalism, brought growth was not what they told us. It was not based on the unleashing of saving and investment, which actually didn't perform very well in this period. It actually worked by providing debt-fueled consumption. It was consumer spending that rose rapidly after 1980 as millions of people, despite having stagnating wages, were able to increase their consumption over time only by borrowing from a financial sector that had been radically transformed and was willing to lend even to people of a low income with few assets. This worked for a period of time, but it created unsustainable trends, growing household debt, growing financial sector debt, the spread of what has been called toxic financial assets in the system. It was a time-limited process, and its time has run out.
You say that's out of gas now, but your formula for revival has a kind of a back-to-the-future feel to it. I mean, I expect to see 57 Chevys, unions and government regulation. We've been told for a long time that's the path to a disaster, but you say it's the way to a better economy. Can we really go back to that?
Well, it's not exactly going back, but after all, the shift to free market institutions and policies after 1980 was also a back to the future, since that was very much the kind of economy
Buccaneer
that we had in the late 19th century and in the 1920s.
So we've gone back before.
So there are these cycles, although it's different each time. That's why the term neoliberalism means a new form of liberal or, which means in the rest of the world, free market economy. So I don't think something from the past is going to emerge in exactly as it was before. But I do think both history and other considerations strongly suggest that the current stagnation can be ended only by a shift toward a more state-regulated form of economy.
David Kott, stand by in Amherst, Massachusetts. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. Reaganomics, free market. Eric Brynjolfsson, let's turn to your analysis here. If that's back to the future, you're very sort of future. You say the machines are coming, they're going to take the jobs. You put that in an optimistic envelope, but it's going to require major reconstruction somewhere. What do you see coming?
Well, that's exactly right. I agree with a lot of the symptoms that David describes, and I think that's something that requires a lot of concern. But Andrew McAfee and I have a very different diagnosis in our book. We have looked at the way the underlying—
The Second Machine Age.
That's right. The book is called The Second Machine Age, which is hearkening back to the First Machine Age, the Industrial Revolution. But this time around, it's mental tasks that are increasingly being automated and augmented by machines.
Because AI, artificial intelligence moving up.
Exactly. Artificial intelligence, even just digital technologies, mm-hmm. Tax preparation software that we're all ordering this month instead of having human tax preparers. I wouldn't necessarily call that AI, but there are lots of examples of software and robots and other technologies increasingly encroaching on things that previously only humans could do.
I have good, serious friends who think that is just going to, I don't know what the right verb is, but overturn, change, wreck society as we know it, that there aren't going to be jobs. We won't know how to live with that.
Well, I have a lot of serious friends, especially in the tech industry, that are also very concerned. I don't think it needs to wreck society, but it will overturn a lot of the ways that we've been depending on jobs. I mean, look at the big three automakers and compare them to what you could call the big three in Silicon Valley, Apple, Google, and Facebook. Mm-hmm. The high-tech companies have one-tenth as many jobs, but 30 times more market cap than the auto companies did in their heyday.
You're talking in that environment about needing to move into what? Guarantee incomes for Americans if they can't find a job because the machine took it? What?
Well, we may look at that going into the future, but as we were writing the book, we became convinced by people like Bob Putnam that people really get a lot of value out of work beyond the paycheck.
Of course.
And so we're looking at ways to keep people working.
But what are they going to do? Massage therapy, or is that machine too?
There are actually a ton of jobs that they potentially could do, interpersonal skills as well as creative tasks. And one of the things we want to do is encourage businesses to help invent those new jobs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about more fundamental fixes, changes for the U.S. economy. Jobs are up, sort of. Wages are not. The future looks very murky, maybe downright bad. So what do we really need here? We've got a couple of great thinkers with us this hour. David Kotz is with us from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Shanghai University of Finance and Economics. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. He says Reaganomics, free market economics, has kind of run its course since the late 70s, early 80s. It's out of gas. We need something new here. He looks at unions, more labor power, more government regulation. It may sound like Back to the Future. We'll hear his case. Eric Brynjolfsson is with us, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Business, co-author with Andrew McAfee of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. The president was very happy about those numbers at the end of last week. But, of course, Republicans were eager to get in there and take some credit as well after all these years. Here was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell interpreting new jobs numbers in the GOP's favor.
After so many years of sluggish growth, we're finally starting to see some economic data that can provide a glimmer of hope. The uptick appears to coincide with the biggest political change of the Obama administration's long tenure in Washington. The expectation of a new Republican Congress. So this is precisely the time to advance a positive pro-growth agenda.
Just the anticipation of a new Republican Congress, and boom, go those jobs numbers. That's great. That's awesome. Not everybody buys it. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren was at an AFL-CIO convention. This was Sunday in Los Angeles. She says, hey, whole system rigged. Got to be changed.
The American people know that the system is rigged against them, and they want us to level the playing field. That's our mandate. That's what we're here to do.
And meanwhile, technology just keeps going. You've got the electronics show, Consumer Electronics in Vegas. ABC talked with Delphi's Kristen Kinley about new radar on their driverless Audi SUV.
What sets this vehicle apart from others that you've probably seen that are being displayed or demonstrated is that this vehicle is actually being taken out onto the roads of Las Vegas at CES and is able to manage pedestrians, real complex driving scenarios that you would often find in urban settings.
Hey, are you listening, truck drivers? Eric Brynjolfsson says, watch out, lawyers and accountants and everybody else. Machines are coming. Daniel is with us from Detroit. Daniel, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see?
Hello, Tom. During conversations like this, I sometimes introduce myself as a professional job destroyer.
Hey, great. Welcome to the party. What does that mean? What does it mean?
Well, we modernize. I mean, here's the thing. We must modernize. We can't not modernize. If we don't, we're going to get devoured by China. Jobs are going to move abroad. So what's the option? Do we want to have a world where we get 20% of people's money and 80% unemployed? I think that's awful. I think that's terrible.
You're in robotics, Daniel. You're bringing robots in the workplace, and that's why you're a professional job destroyer. So if we're going to modernize, you say bring on the robots. That's great. What do we do with all the Americans who then aren't doing those jobs with their hands?
We have to provide for those people, too. A minimum income is just the beginning. I want to free these people to really pursue their passions. Right? Maybe you want to flip burgers, but don't make it be a menial job. Flip burgers because you flip the best darn burgers in the tri-state area. If you want to work with your hands, work with your hands. There is work out there. There's work in communities. There's work helping people. We need to enable people to really get involved, to get engaged, and to really live a life, whether that's with their hands, by writing, by making art. We can probably get a lot of inspiration from the Nordic countries, from Iceland. I mean, Iceland has done a great job of essentially making a minimum income system across its country. And they've exploded with happiness, with high education. We could do a lot to copy that.
Exploding with happiness and high education. This sounds awesome. But Daniel, how do you make that happen? I mean, look around the U.S. Is it happening now, that this lovely land where machines do the work and we make fantastic burgers, the best ever?
No, it's absolutely not. We're heading closer towards more of a Gibson-esque dystopia where corporations own everything and most people are ground into the dust.
How do you shift tracks? How do you get us on the right track? What's it take to make it change?
Well, I don't think the legislature is going to do it. It's going to take marches. It's going to take protests. Or things are just going to get violent. I don't want it to become violent, but I think it's inevitable.
Daniel, you put your finger on exactly why we're here with exactly this conversation today. Nobody wants that. At least I don't want that. Eric Brynjolfsson, that sounds Icelandic to me. Brynjolfsson?
It is Icelandic.
Exploding with happiness.
I was smiling when Daniel was talking about happiness in Iceland, and he really gets it about the robots. You know, technology has always been destroying jobs. It's always been creating jobs. The solution is not to try to hang on to the old jobs and create regulations that ban, you know, the invention of new jobs or the replacement. The solution, we always have had a dynamic economy, and that's when we've thrived. Sadly, we went from having about 5% of the jobs in America require government permits to over 30% now. That's a formula for sclerosis. If we could make it easier for people to help invent those new jobs and also to reskill jobs, we have to fundamentally reinvent education so that people have the skills for the new sets of jobs as robots take away some of the more menial, repetitive jobs. Ultimately, I'm with Daniel. This should be good news. We could be maybe exploding with happiness, I think were his words, if people get a chance to do the things they really enjoy, which often involve creativity, interpersonal skills, exactly the things that machines are bad at.
I hear a lot of people saying this. This must be kind of a meme idea out there. Yes, let machines do the work, and then everybody else go off and do the thing you have a passion for. Do that thing that you're really creative and great at. You say that, what, regulation of fingernail shops is
exactly.
Like getting
nail
in
salons.
The way. Yeah, but come on. I mean, are we really – can how many are we now? 350 million or whatever it is? There's a lot of us. Can we all go out, let the machines do the work, and we all go out and like discover our passion and become the most creative burger maker and everything's great? Who's going to pay us to do
all that? The bottom line is this. As the technology improves, the pie is getting bigger. We are wealthier than we've ever been in history.
0.0001%, we see it all sitting
absolutely
up.
It's been allocated in a very unequal way. So it's not like we don't have the resources. The question is, how do we want to create shared prosperity? There's two things we can do. Mm-hmm. One is to help find jobs and work for those people by coming with new skills, new education. That's what America has always done. America's greatest idea was mass public education in the 1830s, the high school in the 1920s, the GI Bill. We've stagnated on that side. We need to reinvent education and reinvest in it. But we also need to make it easier for entrepreneurs to invent some of those new jobs, because you're not going to like freeze in the agriculture of the 1790s. That would have kept Henry Ford from innovating, or Steve Jobs, or Bill Gates.
So you say minimum income guaranteed by the government, and then beyond that, people go follow their passion?
I think we may eventually get there. I think there's a step before that that we want to focus on. It's called wage subsidies, or the earned income tax credit.
We've got that.
And it could be massively expanded. It should should be massively expanded because it basically rewards people for working and it rewards businesses for coming up with jobs for those people.
Where does the money come from?
We've got lots of money.
Yeah, but I'm asking whose pocket?
I would start with what economists call Pigouvian taxes, carbon taxes. There are taxes on bad things like pollution. I would also shift taxes away from labor and onto value-added taxes and capital taxes.
You go with Thomas Piketty all the way to wealth. You're going to tax wealth to do that?
I think we could have a much more progressive income tax. In the 1950s, we had a 90% tax. No one is advocating anything nearly that high. But I think most economists would agree that we could go with higher taxes at the upper end without slowing down economic growth.
So there's a kind of back and forth to the future. David Kotz, take us into some of your solutions here. If this era in capitalism has become sclerotic and it's sputtering out, exactly what would you do to bring back more labor power? That's one of your key pieces of the formula. And more government regulation? Eric Brynjolfsson says less, please.
Well, it is a paradox that technology keeps increasing the output per worker, yet in recent times, the majority has not been benefiting from this.
That's right.
And I'll give you an example of how working people can benefit from technological change. And it involves regulating the market. In West Coast longshoring, where the ships are loaded, there has been rapid technological change over the years. Instead of burly men walking up gangplanks with heavy loads on their backs, it's shifted to giant containers being lifted by cranes onto the ships. Well, the trade union in the West Coast longshoring, led by longtime socialists, saw to it, they had the bargaining power to see to it that the workers who did that work shared in the benefits. Longshore workers do not need much formal education to do a good job. On the West Coast, the average pay is about $100,000 a year.
But isn't that getting robotized? Won't longshoremen work be robotized right off the playing board here?
Well, if that gets robotized, jobs will appear somewhere else. The point is that if workers, wherever they're working, have strong trade unions, then they have a chance to share in the growing productivity of the economy.
How do you get that? Strong trade unions, that went away a long time ago now. The unionization rate is so low now. The laws don't tilt that way. The Congress doesn't seem inclined to change them. How do you get that?
Well, that requires a combination of effort by the labor movement and changes in the laws that govern labor management relations. Keep in mind that at the end of the 1920s, there were articles written saying the labor movement was declining and was going to disappear. And then it went through a big rebirth in the 1930s and 40s. This can happen again. If the labor laws were enforced, I think we'd see a big surge in unionization. After all, public opinion surveys show that the percentage of people who say they would like to belong to a union is about in the mid-50s, a majority of people. Yet, this is not reflected in the actual unionization rate.
But in the 30s and 40s, you had first a depression, then you had an alternate system out there, Karl Marx and Lenin and all the rest saying, come over here. I mean, the old powers felt really threatened by all kinds of things. Do you see that kind of fire under them today to change?
So you sound like you read my book. Yes, I agree. I agree with that point. There are this kind of stagnant period in the global capitalist system does bring about threats. Right now in Greece, a left-wing socialist political group is the favorite to win office. This kind of long-run stagnation produces growing political movements on both the left and the right. And at some point, this becomes a serious enough threat that I think the powers that be will begin to think about perhaps compromising with labor instead of trying to crush trade unions.
I'm trying to visualize that exact moment when that happens with everything going on with spending around congressional elections. David in Hartford, Connecticut. You're on the air, David. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Tom. My question is in response to the first thing that came across the air this morning. Before the show even started, you asked, how can we make the system work for everybody?
Or at least as close as we can get, yes.
My response is, you cannot make it work for everybody. unless the people running the country have the view that every human life has innate value. And my example of how we presently view the situation is this. The same week, Walmart was in the news for cutting health care benefits to 30,000 of its employees. Forbes came out with its list of 10 wealthiest individuals. Four out of the 10 were Walmart family folks, worth together $144 billion with a B, dollars.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, it does not take $144 billion to sustain four people's lives. And until we agree that, okay, it's great to have passion to make the best burger, but that's damn hard if you're working three jobs just to make ends meet and you haven't had a raise out of the lowest salary level for 6 years.
David, we've got it. I think pretty loud and clear. You lay out a compelling picture there. But you ask, you know, you say it won't change until politicians believe every human life has innate value. I mean, the Constitution, all men are created equal. It's sort of right down the bedrock of American life. Eric, what do we need in terms of thinking to get into a more flexible frame of mind that acknowledges that not everybody is benefiting and many are hurting in the current state, and it could get worse, and we need to do something to adjust?
There's no question that's happening. It's a central theme of the of our book. The difference is that I think we have a very different diagnosis of what's going on. It's not that we haven't done a good enough job freezing in the old jobs and mandating higher wages for them. It's that the economy is fundamentally changing. Now, take Walmart as an example. You know, there are automatic kiosks coming in that are replacing checkout people, just like the longshoremen are going to be replaced by robots increasingly. And every industry is going through this convulsion. We simply don't have the option of trying to freeze in the old jobs. If we passed a law that said, you know, Walmart had to pay higher wages, that would just speed the adoption of automatic kiosks.
But if we just robotize those jobs and we don't have a change of thinking that says we need to do something to deal with the fallout from that,
exactly,
we've got trouble.
Well, that's exactly it. So the solution is not to freeze the old jobs. The solution is to help prepare people with skills for the new jobs. One technique that's worked for a couple hundred years and I think will continue to work is changing education. And now it's not the same old kinds of education. A grand bargain is possible with much higher teacher pay, more freedom and creativity in terms of the teaching and also in terms of what students are taught, but also an end of tenure, more adherence to standards, longer school days and years. The net result would be an increase in our ability to learn new skills, and the people who used to work as checkout people at Walmart would be able to do new kinds of jobs in healthcare, for instance, and in creative professions.
David Kotz, you want to shut down free trade agreements. Is that part of the answer here? No China. We don't want to compete with your wages anymore. No Bangladesh.
Well, not exactly. In my view, the global economy and national economies will work best if trade is regulated, not if it's ended.
I don't mean ended, but what does regulated mean? That would protect American wages, would it not? Isn't that kind of like ending?
Well, it will slow the transitions. It will give workers a chance to adjust to changes in where things are produced in the world. We had a system somewhat like that in several decades after World War II. There was the most rapid economic growth of any long period in capitalist history. We could institute a system in which trade and capital movements are regulated, not to stop them and close them off, but to make sure that they happen on a timescale that allows people to adjust to it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about more fundamental fixes for the U.S. economy. Jobs are up, sort of. Wages are not. What do we do? You can join us this hour with Eric Brynjolfsson, co-author of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. David Kotz is with us. He's author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. He says, we're done with this cycle. Yes, a lot of money was made since 1980, Reagan and all the rest, but it's over. Look around. Robert, in Governor, New York. Robert, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had to call in because the vibration I'm getting from a lot of the people that are talking on the program, it feels like people who are, you know, have good jobs and they really do not connect with the people, you know, the burger flippers they're talking about. They, you know, they act like, oh yeah, no, they're going to be happy if, you know, they just, you know, flip burgers better, you know. And
so preach to us, Robert. I mean, we're doing this show because we are thinking about those burger flippers, but what do you see? Good. What do you do?
I'm the director of one of the largest food pantries in northern New York, and okay. And every week we see people come through the door with the deer in their head look in their eyes, saying they can't believe that they're coming into a food pantry. You know, people with degrees, you know, and, yep. And all of a sudden they're without work. And I have to say that, you know, I'm a Republican, but I have to say that this new push by President Obama to make education free or more accessible, I am fully behind that.
Community college for free, yeah.
I believe that most people would take advantage of improving their lives. And I think we shot ourselves in the foot beginning with NAFTA. And I agree with the one fellow who was talking about getting a grip on things a little bit more than we have.
Robert, and if we got community college for a lot more people, you say you got people with degrees already coming to your food pantry. So will that be enough? Will that do it? Will that generate a whole bunch of new jobs? Do you believe that it will
help? Yep. I mean, there's people that are stuck in these low-end jobs, and they're just stuck. They just can't seem to get out, you know? I think a better educated workforce would always be better for us.
Robert, I'm for that, and we appreciate the view from the food pantry there, that deer in the headlights look. This is a Republican calling in saying, you know, don't forget what this feels like to an awful lot of people out there in the economy right now. Valerie in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on, Val.
My comment is just that 50% of the people in the world have an IQ of less than 100, and 50% have one higher than 100.
I have no idea if that's true, but...
That's the definition.
Well, 100 is supposed
to
be...
Oh, I see. 100 is the mean. Okay. All right. So
we keep getting jobs that require more and more education, but we don't create people who are able to learn more and more. There used to be a place in the world for those people. They could go out and look for gold in Alaska or work on the fields or something like that, but there's no place for them anymore. We keep efficientizing them out of a job.
So what do we do?
Assuming,
yeah.
You know, I ask every single politician I meet that question, and nobody has given me an answer of what do we do with dumb people.
Well, let's put it to our panel. Not everybody's a cheetah, okay? Not everybody's going to invent the next, I don't know, super technology, and yet everybody needs a job. Val, that makes Val skeptical about the whole idea of educating ourselves to success here. How do we structure for that in the age of brilliant technologies, Eric?
Well, and I think this is a really important question, but there's also a fundamental misunderstanding that there's only one dimension of where humans beat machines, and that's our intelligence. The fact is that we're much better machines at a lot of interpersonal skills, also a lot of dexterous skills currently. I see an explosion of jobs in the caring professions, whether it's people taking care of children or nurses or older people, coaching. I don't think the Patriots would have been inspired by a robot at halftime to go out there and play harder, or leaders who are robots. So I think there's a whole set of jobs that involve interacting with other people. We have millions of years of evolution that have taught us to connect to other people.
But we don't pay for those.
Some of them actually pay pretty well. I think Bill Belichick isn't paid too badly.
Yeah, but I doubt Bill Belichick falls on the downside of the IQ curve. How would you like to work at the wages that a whole lot of daycare workers or nursing home workers make?
I think we're going to have to work harder to make those jobs more appealing, because that's where the future is going to be increasingly.
Appealing? You mean raise the wages? How do you do that?
I think that
something has to change for that to happen, because now you know where the money – it's right. Not there, so address it. How do you –
There are a number of ways.
Unionize? Is that David?
No. No, I don't think that that's going to be the solution because that tends to lock in the existing jobs. I think that I'm with Robert's earlier comment about mm-hmm. education. A lot of these skills, these jobs do require some more education. So if you want to be a successful nurse, there's not just the interpersonal skills. There's also some academic skills that you learn in community colleges and four-year colleges.
Yeah, but now you can get all the education you want. And if you go to work in a daycare center, you're not likely to take home a big paycheck.
Well, there's a whole spectrum of jobs that involve interpersonal skills from social workers to daycare workers to leaders and managers that have different levels of educational requirements. There are some jobs that don't require a ton of education. But I think Robert was right that on balance, unemployment and wages are much better for people who have more education. So that's part of the solution. But we can also pay people directly. I mentioned earlier the earned income tax credit.
Yep.
Direct wage subsidies will help lift up people who right now the free market isn't rewarding as much as we think they should be.
Yes, David Cutts, please.
I think education is great and more of it would be better. But if the American people raise their average educational level, it's not going to have any effect on the job structure in the economy. Among the fastest growing occupations in the U.S. are custodians and restaurant workers. What they need is a living wage. If a living wage were required, not from government subsidies, but from employers in those sectors, it would put pressure on the employers to upgrade the productivity of the jobs. After all, this can be done. In Sweden, workers in those sectors make a living wage. We saw that in Denmark, McDonald's workers get $20 an hour.
Can I ask David a question?
This is possible. This would have a really big impact.
Question from Eric for you, David Cutts.
Yeah, so I agree with your goal of raising those wages. Why would you want to specifically tax or make the people who come up with jobs have to pay those wages? Why shouldn't we all contribute it? Why are you targeting the people who invent the new jobs as the ones who have to bear the full burden?
I think there is a good case that if a product is going to succeed in the market, those who produce it should get a living wage. If it can't pay a living wage –
I agree they should get a living wage. The question is who should pay that?
Let me finish. If it can't get a living wage, then those workers have to be partly supported by the public as a whole, which means the employer is being subsidized by the public. If fast food should pay a living wage rather than the taxpayers having to subsidize McDonald's by providing government-funded health care and food stamps.
Eric, that just seems reasonable to me. Eric, as I read you, I think you said, we were talking earlier, you said that like our intellectual property laws, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, Mark Zuckerberg creates Facebook, $30 billion. We could change those rules.
Yes, that's right. We could change the rules about how we allocate wealth in terms of intellectual property and also in terms of our tax code and wages. And I think I would like to encourage companies to come up with more jobs for the people you were just talking about. And I don't necessarily want to punish the people who invent those jobs. It's hard to think of jobs for some of the people who don't have the skills and are increasingly having to compete with robots.
But do we want to change those laws? I mean, after all, we've got Silicon Valley, at least in that respect, with the envy of the world. We've got it for a reason, I assume, incentives. Yes. I mean, people go out and dream and kill themselves because they might be the next Zuckerberg.
I think that's part of it. I've spoken to a lot of them, and most of them don't necessarily think that you need $30 billion to have that level of reward, that level of incentive. I don't think that's the main solution. That's the main part of it. But I don't think that that's going to make a big difference if we had slightly different, more progressive taxes.
Stephen in Savannah, Georgia. Stephen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I think that I agree with Eric more than I do Mr. Cutts. I'm sorry if I mispronounce his name.
That's fine.
You got it right.
I don't understand where he comes up with these ideas. I mean, we are on the front lines here in Savannah. We are a environmentally based business. We have 20-plus employees.
Great.
We are educating some of our younger employees, trying to help them go to school. Some of our Mexican employees, we allow them, their kids, to rake straw at our farms to keep the money themselves to help get them educated.
So what's the problem in David Kotz's view?
We are regulated to death by the EPD already. I mean, it's to the point where you don't even return the phone calls. Make them show up at your office. To me, what would help out businesses like myself and my friends who are doing the same thing that I'm doing, give us some tax breaks to help our employees get educated. I mean, we are taxed to pieces. When you're paying $14,000, $15,000 quarterly estimates on your income and you're trying to help your employees, you're trying to deal with these regulations, you're paying your taxes, you're doing everything, and still getting kicked down, you know?
Stephen, hold the phone, Stephen. David Kotz, there's a skeptic in Savannah who thinks he's making jobs. He's willing to help educate people, and he's worried that your regulatory tax path, well, you hear it. It's kind of the neoliberal critique of it.
Well, let me step further outside the box. What's the problem here? The fundamental problem that both Eric and I have been confronting is that technology eliminates jobs over time. It increases output per worker, and this causes unemployment and dislocation. The solution is so obvious. It's staring us in the face, which is to divide the work among the people. People need work in order to have decent lives, but a capitalist system has a problem with this. Our capitalist system, to be healthy, has to keep producing more and more goods, which is driving global climate change. One can argue that a democratic socialist planned economy would be able over time to handle growing technological innovation and productivity growth by gradually reducing the work week, with everyone working, you know, first 38, 35, 32 hours, getting a living wage, and having more time to for their own pursuits.
How's that going in France?
Well, it's not going. They have a socialist president, but they have a capitalist economy. There aren't really any there is no place in the world that has a democratic and participatory planned economy. But I do think that is the best solution for the future.
Eric?
Well, Dave and I agree on a lot, but I think he just hit the nub of where we disagree, which is I don't think the solution is to take existing jobs and divide them among existing people as they get more and more automated. The solution has to be to create new jobs, and part of that is to give people skills so they have this, are able to do the new jobs. But part of it is also to reward the people who invent what those new jobs are. David and I and a lot of other people would have a hard time thinking of what all those new jobs are. We need to crowdsource that question and reward people who come up with the new jobs, in part by wage subsidies, in part by less regulation, and thank them for helping to get us out of this problem of the old jobs being automated. But we can't just try and hang on to those old jobs. That will never work in the long run.
I wonder where is the fluidity in this conversation? Because, you know, you can talk and talk, but things don't seem to change. We had a caller who called in, a young caller last week from Cleveland. Chris, I think, was his name. He's 28, 29 years old, and he said, look, all of his working life has been in this bust period. And he's kind of just checking out. Listen to this. You know, he was responding to the jobs numbers, and listen to his sort of I'm out of here attitude.
All of these high-order statistics and, you know, theories about our economy and who's winning and who's not. The Dow's over 18,000. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm not in the market. I'm not going to be in the market. I'm not retiring. I don't own a home. I'm not going to own a home. So it seems like inside baseball to me.
Caller Chris from Cleveland last week, a young American. David Kotz, I worry about that. I mean, he's kind of that's the sound of a certain kind of surrender there. At least compared to our traditional optimism and a view of opportunity and let's go get it. If that becomes widespread, and there's a lot of it out there, we're in trouble.
Yeah, I agree. And we really need some big changes so that everyone can have a decent life, which our economy could provide if it were restructured. I don't believe in saving the old jobs. I just believe in making sure that there's a job for everyone that they can do and can make a living wage from it. Our economy can't seem to provide that these days.
When you hear Elizabeth Warren talk about the system being rigged and changed, do you think she's singing your song?
Well, I agree with much of what she says, but I do favor bigger changes than what she proposes. I think it would be good to have a more equally shared capitalism, such as we had in the post-World War II decades. But I'm concerned that capitalism over the long run, not too long, next few decades, because it can provide jobs only through growing commodity production, growing consumption, this is going to change the global climate in ways that'll be a disaster.
Eric Brynjolfsson, we've just got a minute. Forgive me, David. We've just got a minute left here. If you were Czar Eric, what's the change you would make to get us on a better track?
Well, there's no question the pie is getting bigger. And shame on us if we don't create shared prosperity. We have the
Which
tools.
We are not. That
we
is
are,
clear
we are not
in the
doing
numbers.
It. And the problem is not that we haven't locked in the old jobs. The problem is we haven't been creating new jobs fast enough. I think we have a formula for doing that. Andy and I describe it at the end of our book involving education, entrepreneurship, wage subsidies. I don't think that it's actually that hard to do it. It's a question of whether we diagnose the problem correctly and whether we step up to do it. Ultimately, technology is not destiny. We shape our destiny.
Can we stay on the path we're on now and be a healthy economic society?
Technology, yes, but we're going to have to make economic changes and policy changes.
Which means politics.
Yes,
sounds like
does.
We don't disagree so much in the end.
No, technology,
I think
we have...
Technology is not destiny.
That's right.
David Kotz is author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David, in Amherst, Massachusetts, at New England Public Radio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Eric Brynjolfsson at MIT, co-author with Andrew McAfee of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Always great to see you, Eric.
Real pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.